Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
So it is 3 minutes after 11, so we'll get started. On behalf of Leading Age New York and the law firm of Hinman Straub, welcome to today's conference call, which concerns the releases that many not-for-profit and public facilities have executed in conjunction with the Universal Settlement. I'm Dan Heim, Executive Vice President of Leading Age New York, and I'm joined here by Jim Klein, President and CEO of Leading Age New York, and Darius Kirstein, Senior Policy Analyst, and also by Sean Doolin of Hinman Straub, who is General Counsel to Leading Age New York and one of the two state-designated Universal Settlement Trustees. Your facility should have received an email from Darius Kirstein on Wednesday afternoon entitled Time-Sensitive Universal Settlement Information. As indicated in this email, the state has determined that the universal settlement release that you executed on behalf of your nursing home is defective due to revisions that you made to the state's pre-approved release form. The state has determined that it will not agree to these changes and has requested that you execute a release form that has been approved by the state. The January 27th email included two attachments. First, a memo explaining this issue further, and secondly, the proper form of release for your facility. We'll be referring to both documents on this call. The state is asking your facility to review and execute the attached release, have it notarized, and returned to the designated trustee by January 31st, 2016. The purpose of today's call is to provide you with a brief update on the Universal Settlement, to further explain the need for the revised releases and the practical implications of executing the state form, to provide instructions for returning the release form, and to address any other questions that you may have. This call is also being recorded for those who cannot join and will be made available this afternoon to all facilities that received the January 27th email from us. Since there are several parties on this call and we want everyone to be able to hear what is said and to ask questions, we ask that you please put your phone on mute during the entire call, except for when you are asking a question. Please do not put this call on hold, since we will all hear your organization's hold message or mute, and we'll know who you are. Thank you again for joining us today and for your interest in participating in the Universal Settlement. It's my pleasure now to introduce today's presenter, Sean Doolin of the law firm of Hinman Straub. Sean?
Thank you, Dan. Good morning, folks. Before we dive into the release issue, why don't I provide a brief overview of where we stand with respect to Universal Settlement overall. So with the exception of this issue with regarding the releases and the modifications to releases, up until this point, out of the roughly 611 current nursing home operators in the state, both proprietary and non-for-profit, approximately 602 current owners or operators have executed releases, which means that approximately 98% of the licensees in the state have agreed to the Universal Settlement. So that gives you some context of where we stand overall. And with the exception of two issues, the modifications to the releases and CMS approval, the state has given us assurances that they will be in the position to declare quote-unquote universality, which means that they would move forward and agree to the Universal Settlement. The time frame for that, and which explains somewhat of the urgency of this call and the modifications to the releases, is February 1. So they will review all of the agreements and releases that have been executed on January 31st and then into February 1 and make a determination as to whether they want to agree to the Universal Settlement, which again explains why we have the time crunch that we're in. With regard to the release issue, a little bit of context and history here I think is helpful. The issue of personal liability actually first came up not in the context of the Universal Settlement, but actually in the context of another nursing home litigation called the base price litigation, which affected, you know, around 230 operators in the state, mostly proprietary. There were a handful of not-for-profit. As part of the settlement of that lawsuit, the state insisted upon the personal liability of the operators of the facility in the context of the settlement. And their rationale for that was that the owners of – they want the owners of the facilities to be on the hook, so to speak, to the extent that the facility itself is unable to comply with the provisions of the agreement, or for some other reason there's a breach in the agreement and the state is either exposed or has a cause of action against that facility. Again, it's based on the rationale that the owner has a direct fiduciary interest and legal interest and financial interest in the operations of that facility, and the dollars can flow to that individual owner. So that's sort of the precedent that the state used with regard to individual liability and indemnification that first started with that lawsuit and is now carried forward to universal settlement. It has been our position all along that the rationale in the base price litigation for individual indemnification and liability does not pertain to non-for-profit or voluntary facilities. And the reason that is that there, quite simply, is there is not an ownership interest in a non-for-profit. Indeed, there is no owner of a non-for-profit, whether it be a pure non-for-profit or a county-owned home. There are board members, there are executives, there are employees, but there's no ownership interest. Likewise, the non-for-profit corporation law provides specific protections to ensure that the dollars that flow to the non-for-profit are not misappropriated to individuals. So there's both protections in law and in the governance of a non-for-profit to ensure that personal liability is unnecessary. And I think we made a very compelling case to the state, and at least we were under the impression that they had in fact agreed that non-for-profits did not need to execute the personal liability provision, I mean, the agreement release rather, which had the personal liability or indemnification provisions included. And in fact, many non-for-profits executed the release in its original form with the liability and indemnification provisions, and about 122, many of whom are on the phone right now, decided to revise the agreement, appropriately so, with guidance from counsel, including ourselves, under the impression that and understanding that, in fact, that was acceptable to the state. Complicating matters for us, a number of the proprietary homes likewise decided to, upon advice of counsel, decided to revise their releases as well, eliminating personal liability. And there were about 180-plus of those facilities. And that obviously raised the issue initially with the state. The state 2 weeks ago insisted that those proprietary homes that revised their releases and in turn eliminated personal indemnification or liability needed to re-execute their releases and submit them back to the state in their original form. And to the best of my knowledge, virtually all, or I should say a vast majority of those proprietary homes have in fact moved forward and re-executed the original releases. So where things stood at the beginning of this week was you had all proprietary homes in the position of having to execute the personal liability and indemnification provisions, and you had a little over half of the not-for-profits who had done so voluntarily without, you know, executing the original agreement without limiting the personal liability or indemnification provisions. So the state contacted us, I believe it was late Tuesday afternoon, and alerted us to the fact that they were concerned that some non-for-profits executed the indemnification provisions and some did not, and that all the proprietary homes had executed the indemnification clause. And they were of the mind that they needed consistency across the board, that there were some indirect threats of litigation by some counsel, that facilities weren't being treated the same, and they decided quite definitively that we needed to move forward and have those non-for-profit facilities re-execute the releases in their original form, which included the indemnification language. So there's a lot of fingers that can be pointed. Obviously, this late in the process is an especially challenging situation for us. But instead of pointing fingers or getting into the blame game, you know, frankly, we're just in the position to ensure that we can comply in an as expeditious way as possible, and to the extent that you are comfortable re-executing those releases, that in fact you do so, and that come Monday morning on February 1st, to the extent that we have the universality requirement as mandated by the state, that we've done our best efforts to get there, and that we can move forward with the universal settlement. So that gives you a little bit of background and context, which I thought would be helpful. With respect to the indemnification provisions specifically, why don't I provide some general observations, try to address some anticipated questions, with the one caveat being, you know, at the end of the day, to the extent that you are not comfortable executing or have additional questions with regard to executing the agreement or release in its original form, that you should consult with your counsel, whether it's your individual counsel or the facilities counsel. So with that in mind, what does the indemnification, what are you agreeing to? What does the indemnification actually mean? And what it does is, what it provides is that the state would be protected, would be indemnified by you to the extent that a third party seeks against the state an action and a judgment from the state in which a court determines that the money that was distributed under the universal settlement was misappropriated and should have been indeed provided or distributed to that third party. In other words, whether it's the dollars themselves that are distributed, or for that matter, to the extent that there is a rate appeal or a litigation that is being settled as a result of universal settlement, in which a party has an interest to that litigation or rate appeal, and they were not a party to the universal settlement, nor did they receive proceeds from the universal settlement, they would, to the extent that they had received a judgment against the state, the individual and the not-for-profit facility would indemnify, hold harmless the state from that liability. So where does that take us? Well, I mean, to the best of our knowledge, the only scenario that we can envision that coming into play is if there is a former owner who believes that either A, they're entitled to the proceeds of the universal settlement, or B, they had a rate appeal that was settled as a result of the universal settlement, or litigation that was settled as a result of the litigation, and in fact they believe that they were entitled to those proceeds, and they went to a court and a court agreed that they were entitled to those proceeds, and they brought an action against the state. So to a great extent, and perhaps there are other scenarios that we cannot contemplate or envision, really what we're looking at here are those situations in which the non-for-profit had a previous owner, and that previous owner is entitled or believes that they are entitled to the proceeds from the universal settlement. So, you know, again, the idea of a previous owner in the non-for-profit world is unusual. Typically, it results in, to the extent that there is a new non-for-profit, it results in a changeover in the board of directors, or for that matter, the officers, but the corpus, the actual not-for-profit, remains intact, and it's the same entity. Likewise, to the extent that there is a takeover or a merger of non-for-profits, it's two non-for-profits that come together as their surviving entity. Are there scenarios in which a non-for-profit had a previous owner? In other words, the not-for-profit bought the facility from a prior owner, a prior not-for-profit, or for that matter, a prior for-profit? Absolutely. It's just that it is, in most cases, the unusual corporate ownership path. So to a great extent, to the extent that this provides some comfort, to the extent that there was no prior owner to the facility, it appears that in most cases, and virtually every case that we can imagine, that there is no other third party that actually has a right to those settlement proceeds. Likewise, it's important to note that under the not-for-profit corporation law, a corporation, a not-for-profit corporation, is permitted to indemnify individuals for legal actions that they take on behalf of the corporation within the scope of their employment. So to the extent that your bylaws provide an indemnification of officers or directors, or for that matter, you execute a separate indemnification of the individual by the not-for-profit, that should provide some additional protection from the individual to the extent that you're concerned about personal liability. Lastly, the state has indicated that the most likely scenario in which this would play out is to the extent, again, that there is a judgment issued against the state by a third party, that they would logically seek reimbursement and indemnification from the facility itself prior to going to the individual. And in fact, if in fact the it would only be the scenario in which the non-for-profit entity did not have the financial wherewithal to indemnify the state, there would be some triggering of liability to the individual. So that hopefully gives you some context as well as some of the legal guidelines by which you can either move forward or not. Again, to the extent that there are concerns or you do have additional questions, you can either certainly ask them of us, but also consult with your individual or your facility's attorney. Just in terms of process, as you know, having received the letter or the memorandum from us, we are looking for a return of the original release that was included in the notice you received a couple days ago by the 31st, which is Sunday. To the extent that you can PDF via email the document to us here at Hinman Straub, that would be acceptable, with a hard copy to follow next week. Knowing that we're dealing with a limited time frame, the state is willing to accept, at least at the outset, an emailed copy or PDF copy of that release. So why don't I pause there and open the floor to any questions that you might have.
Sean, this is Jeff Bernfeld. I just wanted to add one thing to what you said. Another way you can make sure that you're protected is if a not-for-profit is being sold, you make sure in your sales agreement that you address specifically not just dates before and after adjustments apply, but you address specifically who's getting universal settlement funds. And that will also go a long way to making sure nothing like this could be a problem.
Good point. Thank you, Jeff.
Sure.
What would be the email address to send these agreements to?
Sure. You can send them to me. My email address is, and we could have this circulated to everyone on the call, is S as in Sam, or Sean, Doolin, D as in David, O-O-L-A, N as in Nancy, at HinmanStraub.com. Hinman Straub is one word, H-I, N as in Nancy, M as in Michael, A, N as in Nancy, S as in Sam, T, R, A, U, B as in boy, .com. sdoolin@hinmanstraub.com.
And one final question. In the date on the paragraph 2, what date goes in there for 2015?
The date, this is the date of you're executing the agreement?
No, this is in paragraph 2. It says the Universal Settlement Agreement dated as of something.
Okay, you can leave that blank, and the state will fill that in on when they execute the agreement.
Okay.
So a question from a county-owned, former county-owned home. This is the county talking. We sold about a year and a half ago. We have a new owner. We both have an interest. It's our understanding that the funds would go into escrow and we would have to negotiate for them. But the indemnification in that way does not involve the state, right? So we wouldn't be personally, or I wouldn't be personally, guaranteeing anything in that settlement process, right? It's for claims that potentially would come later?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, this is Mike Tartaglia from McKinney Nursing and Rehab. I just had a question. We're part of Health and Hospitals Corporation. I'm not sure at this point if our central office is going to execute the release and agreement for all the HHC facilities or whether it has to be done at the facility level. I'm not sure if Anthony Knowles is on the call.
I think your original agreement was executed at the facility level. But the attorneys who were involved on behalf of HHC were David Florman and Joe Willie.
John, hi. It's David Florman here. Is that Mike on the line?
Yes, Mike from McKinney.
Yeah, hi. This has been handled through our office and through Sal Russo's office.
Okay, I don't have to execute this revised agreement from my end?
Well, I don't think any decision has been made as to who is going to do or whether anybody's going to do anything, but it will be coordinated through Sal's office. So we'll talk to you offline.
Okay. Thank you.
In the email that was sent to us with the two owner releases, there's a current owner release, 127.15 is the one PDF file. The other file is current owner release, HB. Which one of these are we supposed to sign?
Yes, that's a very good question.
I'm sorry, could you just repeat the question again?
In the email that was sent to us on the 28th from David Archer, there are two current owner releases.
Okay.
One of the files is... The name of the file is Current Owner Release 012715. The other PDF file is Current Owner Release in parentheses HB.
Okay, so I would suggest you should have also received an email from Leading Age which has the appropriate release for you to sign. The two releases that you received actually apply to two different types of nursing homes. There is a separate release that is unique for hospital-based nursing homes, and the Leading Age email that you received should have only provided those releases to those hospital-based nursing homes. The other release on the Leading Age email was just the generic release for non-hospital-based nursing homes. So I would, to the extent that you are a non-hospital, I would go back to the Leading Age email that you received, and that will include attached the appropriate release.
Thank you.
So this might be an obvious question, but if we don't send the release back re-signed by Monday, are we not in the universal settlement?
That's correct.
If we had gone down to the LaGuardia Marriott and signed the document down there, we don't need to sign anything different, correct? I didn't.
If you had executed the release in its original form without any modification, you do not need to re-execute the release. If you had received an email with the new release from Leading Age, then it's an indication you modified the release. I believe some counsel may have sent you the release erroneously, thinking that you had modified the release when you, in fact, did not modify the release. So I would suggest that, again, to the extent that you received the email from Leading Age, it's an indication that we've reviewed the release with the state, and the state has flagged it as one that has been modified. If you did not receive the email from Leading Age, then you have no obligation to revise the release.
Sean, could I just jump in for a second, because I was down at most of the LaGuardia days?
Sure.
There was, starting from the afternoon of the first day, a pile of the modified releases, and from my memory, virtually everyone that came in from a not-for-profit home at the LaGuardia location signed the modified release. So the fact that it was signed in LaGuardia does not mean you did not sign the modified release. So I think, as Sean put it, if you got an email, you got to re-sign it if you wish. But the fact that it was signed at the signing day does not mean you didn't sign the modified one.
That's right, and this is Paul Green. I was there and at the Rochester signing day as well. And at Rochester, the state was directing the non-for-profits there to sign the revised release. So I don't know what happened in Albany, but in Rochester, certainly a number signed the revised release and may need to sign the old form release now. I agree with Sean. Go by the notification from Leading Age. They have the list from the state of rejected releases. One other thing I just wanted to note generally to clarify, there is a defense obligation in the indemnity. I agree with Sean that any use of the indemnity likely has a low probability, but the indemnity does not just kick in if there's a judgment. There's an indemnity based on defense, also of frivolous claims, if those are raised against the state concerning the funds distributed.
Hi, this is Ross Leach from Ellis Hospital. We have executed the agreement that was sent to us by Leading Age. I sent it to the law offices of Hobman and Straub via courier. I'm assuming that's going to be okay?
That would be fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, Sean. This is John Ahern from Field Home. Is there a sunset to this clause? Is there, or is it ad infinitum?
Unfortunately, there is no sunset.
Hmm. Okay.
Sure. If everything goes according to plan, when might facilities see payment?
That's a good question. You know, and that's obviously been a hot topic as we are getting close to February 2nd. The state budget has appropriated within the Medicaid global cap two payments this fiscal year, the current fiscal year, which expires April 1, which would total $170 million in each payment. So the dollars are there. The way the process would unfold is if we hit universality on Monday, February 1st, then the only thing standing in the way of distribution is CMS approval. CMS and the state have had ongoing discussions. The state is very confident that CMS will grant final approval. Whether that's a day later or a week later, I'm not sure, but they believe it would be imminent. The next step in the process is a distribution of the funds from the state to the trustees, the two trustees, Hinman and O'Connell and Aronowitz, and then the two trustee firms would then distribute the funds to either directly to the facility or to the extent that there's litigation being settled as part of the universal settlement to the council for those facilities. The only thing that would, I think, slow the process down from there is to the extent that a former owner raises their hand and believes that they are entitled to the proceeds of some or all of the proceeds of the universal settlement, the dollars that are being contested, and it may be either the entire universal settlement or a part of the universal settlement, will be held in escrow by the two firms until the issue is resolved between the current owner and the former owner.
Sean, can you tell me if the state has an expectation as to how a not-for-profit would determine who would sign and therefore be providing the personal indemnification, or is a wine-fueled game of rock, paper, scissors acceptable?
The short straw. Do they have an expectation? I'm not sure they necessarily have an expectation. Their obligation is any person who has the authority to bind the corporation authorized to sign the agreement.
Okay, thank you.
Signers should also notice that the release binds their heirs.
Other questions?
Sean?
Yes.
Yeah, I have a question. Sean?
Yes.
This is Alan Gross from Cobble Hill.
Hi, Alan.
You mentioned that, for the remote possibility of a lawsuit against the signer, there should be, in order to protect the signer, there should be some kind of an agreement between the nursing home or the board of directors of the nursing home to indemnify the signer. So, I mean, if we have this deadline by sending this out today, basically, do we have an extra day to get this agreement done, or we must sign the release today?
Alan, this is Jeff Bernfeld. I represent your facility in the Reserve Bed Day Challenge. I have a form of such an agreement for you, and I'll forward it to you after this phone call.
Oh, wonderful. And that would have to be signed by a member of the board of directors?
I would think so. It certainly has to be signed by someone other than the person that's signing the release to the state.
Yeah. So let's say the administrator signs the release. The CEO, certainly to the extent they're authorized to execute the agreement, could sign the indemnification. And again, I would look to your bylaws, because your bylaws may automatically provide that indemnification.
Okay. Okay.
But certainly the greatest protection is the agreement that Jeff is suggesting.
Yes. So you have my email address, Jeff?
I do, Alan. I'll get it to you right after the phone call.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure.
Sean?
Sean?
Yes.
Yes, this is Alan Chevron representing Heritage Commons. I just have a quick question that you just briefly touch upon. So it's due on Sunday, which is the 31st. So as long as they receive it Monday, right?
Well, it would be preferable if you could email it to me prior to Monday, because we are delivering to the state all of the copies, and they'll begin counting Monday morning.
Got you. So we don't have to mail it to you. We just have to
email.
Scan it to you.
Email is scan it in, PDF it in. Email it to us, and then to the extent that you could send the hard copy, Federal Express by next week, that's fine.
Sean, can you give us the mailing address to send the hard copy to?
Sure. It's Hinman Straub, 121 State Street, Albany, New York, 12207.
Thank you.
I unfortunately didn't jot down the email. What's the email address then?
Sure. It's S as in Sean, Doolan, D as in David, OOLAN as in Nancy, @HinmanStraub.com. Hinman Straub, one word, I, N as in Nancy, M as in Michael, A, N as in Nancy, S as in Sam, T, R, A, U, B as in boy, .com.
Thank you.
If we were to overnight a package tonight for Saturday delivery, would somebody be there to accept it on Saturday, or is that not acceptable?
We can make sure someone is here.
Hey, this is Dan Heim. Are there any other questions before we wrap up? So, again, I just would remind those of you on the call that those 118 facilities that need to re-execute their releases did, in fact, get a targeted email from us on January 27th around 4:30 p.m. With the memo that we talked about, as well as the applicable release that you need to execute. So if you have any question about whether or not you are on that list of facilities that needs to re-execute, you can contact us at Leading Age New York. Just dial 518-867-8383 and ask for either Darius Kirstein or Dan Heim, and we can verify whether or not you are, in fact, on that list and need to re-execute your release. And we do appreciate you joining us on the call today. We will, as soon as we have the recording back, we will send that out to everybody who received the email about this call, and we'll also reiterate all the relevant email addresses and filing instructions for the revised forms with all of you. And if you have any questions, further questions, please get in touch with us. Thanks and have a great day.